This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Well, good morning to you, and I'm trying to get my voice cleared up to get going here on this Saturday morning. It's not the weather in Scottsdale, believe me. Weather is great, and about 90% of the snowbirds from the Midwest, I think, have already arrived for Thanksgiving and the winter season. But good to be back with you because Steve Alexander filled in the last couple of weeks when we were at the Farm Broadcasting Convention and the FFA Convention in Indianapolis. Any conventions this week? Nope. Thanksgiving week coming up. A reminder that we will have a holiday shortened trading week in the markets. The markets will be closed Thursday, Thanksgiving Day, and half a day on Friday. So keep that in mind as you do your trading for next week going into Thanksgiving Day week. All in all, in Arizona, crops looking pretty good. I think about four crops of alfalfa hay have been harvested during the summer months, and the cotton pretty well picked clean here in Arizona, where they do raise a long staple cotton that's in good demand around the world. So we'll be checking in on that, checking in on the cattle market, and also talking a little bit about NAFTA this morning, because we continue, as I've said so many times, watching trade negotiations is like watching paint dry. It takes forever. And those people who said, oh, we can renegotiate NAFTA by and have it done by the end of the year, no way, no way. But we'll talk about the current session going underway in Mexico and what the contentious issues are. And there certainly are those contentious issues. So anyway, glad you're with us here on this Saturday morning from Scottsdale, Arizona. And we're going to check in with Tim Andreessen of the CME Group when we come back here on the Saturday morning show.
Corn and soybean growers, we invite you to come and learn how to turn practical data and technology into profitable decisions at the second annual Ag Data Conference. It'll be going on at Coralville, Iowa, coming up the end of November. Making sense of precision technology and the data layers derived from it are key to improving your corn and soybean return on investment. And the best way to learn is from actual experience of other farmers and their advisors, along with a hands-on look at the data products, the drones, and the services that drive success. You'll gain insight and more from the Ag Data Conference, designed by the editors of Farm Progress Information brands Corn Soybean Digest and Farm Futures. Get all the information of the Ag Data Conference by going to the website, theagdataconference.com. It's November 29th and 30th at the Coralville Marriott Hotel near Iowa City, Iowa. TheAgDataConference.com.
We are at 12 minutes after 5 here on the Saturday morning show. And this past week and a half ago, the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention was held in Kansas City. Gives us an opportunity to talk to a lot of people affecting agricultural policy and trade and marketing. Among those, we talked to Tim Andreessen of the CME Group. That's the umbrella group that now handles the trading for the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, as we called it, and the Chicago Board of Trade. And when I arrived in Chicago decades ago, those were the two markets. And interestingly enough, they didn't trade grain anywhere in the world until they learned what the Chicago Board of Trade grain prices were, truly setting the price of grain for the world, and in many cases still are. But talking to Tim Andreessen, the contracts that are now being offered have expanded greatly, and particularly in the area of international trade, because agriculture is indeed international. So when we sat down and talked with Tim, I asked him about the addition of new contracts at the CME Group.
Just within my world, the agricultural world, we also have dairy products, which is part of our remit. We have lumber, which is something you don't hear a lot about. We continue to look at where are the key markets and what are the key products we can offer to our customers to manage risk. This summer, for example, we launched a Australian wheat contract. So producers in Australia can use this contract to manage their risk. It's focused on exports out of Western Australia, and that's a country who they've historically used our products, but now they have a product that's much more specific. And the other thing is, 5 years ago we were sitting here and you asked me about the Kansas City Board of Trade.
Right.
Well, the Kansas City Board obviously became part of CME Group, and at that time we were trading about 20,000 contracts a day. That's now pushing in excess of 50,000, and we've set open interest records there. So, becoming part of that, sitting next to the soft contract, we think has really provided access to many more risk managers around the world, the ability to spread back and forth, particularly in a year like this where you had premium issues around the wheat market. We think that's been really important. And I wouldn't be surprised one day that contract actually trades more than the soft contract.
And, of course, we've seen other wheat contracts, Minneapolis, in the mix this year. Do you see any others coming in?
Well, Minneapolis, is our partner. They're while they're an independent exchange, they're available to trade on Globex, which is our electronic trading platform.
Right.
And, again, it's providing people who are managing wheat risk, more flexibility. The world continues to expand. Unlike corn or soybeans, where wherever you go in the world, people are going to index their price to our futures contract, wheat is much more of a regional product.
Right.
So, we see growth around the world in wheat production. One of the areas that you want to keep your eyes on is the Black Sea region.
Talking about options contracts, mm-hmm. continuing to grow?
Absolutely. As you've seen cycles in these markets, and a couple years ago prices were fairly high for producers. They didn't think as much about getting that last 20 cents. Now when we're sitting here with corn prices $3.50, $4 in that range, being really good marketers is more important than it's ever been. And options are one of the tools that we think make a lot of sense. For people who have produced big crops and they're going to have to sell some of it off the combine or maybe after the first of the year, and they're not as excited about selling, this is a great opportunity to replace that ownership with a long options position.
They weren't very excited about selling corn out of the farm bins this year either. Do you see that changing, Tim?
Now, I mean, it's the one of the dynamics of producers is they're always optimistic. If you're going to bet against Mother Nature and you're willing to take on weather and you're willing to take on all that and, every year grow a crop, I mean, that is the epitome of the American entrepreneurial spirit, right?
Yes.
And, that's a big bet. And, being able to do that requires risk management, and that's where using options and things like that really comes in to help them manage that risk.
About four decades ago, when I sat on the Board of Trade director list, I was disappointed that the market wasn't doing a good job of educating people. Since that time, however, I've seen you at state fairs and county fairs and everywhere going after the young people.
If you think about the demographics that have changed, we're seeing more and more people live in cities. We're seeing the little small towns where places like I grew up, shrinking. And as that happens, there's less and less people that know a farmer or see a farmer or their uncle's a farmer or, you know, and they don't really understand agriculture the way kids used to.
Yeah.
And we think it's really important for them to understand that. We think it's important for them to understand the story of where their food comes from. And equally important, we think it's important for them to understand that farmers have risk. And it's just not as simple as I put it in the ground and I get it up every year and I get a price for it, or, you know, I take this animal and I feed it and, you know, I sell it to the packer. One of our focuses is there's risk. And what are the inputs to that? You know, what do I have to go through? Whether it's production risk, then there's market risk. And so we think it's really important, particularly with people not on the farm, but people in the urban areas,
right,
to understand that and to understand the role that the farmer plays in the food value chain.
We welcome your participation in that because it's something that we in farm broadcasting have been doing for years, trying to educate that, I call them the non-farm consumer, about what it takes to put food on the table and a roof over their head and fuel in the tank. And so thank you for doing that.
Well, Orion, you and the farm broadcast community are so critical in sharing that message. You know, we can put the content together. We can go to you know, state fairs and county fairs and do our part. But at the end of the day, you and your colleagues are in a position to help educate the masses to this is what agriculture is all about. And you guys do a job we could only help with.
Cooperative venture.
Yes.
Thank you, Tim Andreessen with the CME Group.
Thank you, Orion.
It is 20 minutes after 5 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show as we continue to work on The Voice, but it'll clear up sooner or later. Good to have you with us here on the Saturday morning show, and we're going to talk about developments in the NAFTA negotiations, the North American Free Trade Agreement, when we come back here on the Saturday morning show. Oh, the contentious NAFTA renegotiation talks, another round underway in Mexico City. But here in the U.S., some pro-trade Republicans are growing worried that President Donald Trump may try to quit the NAFTA free trade deal entirely rather than negotiate a compromise that preserves its core benefits. At the fifth round of talks to modernize the North American Free Trade Agreement kicked off in Mexico yesterday, several Republicans interviewed by Reuters expressed concerns that tough U.S. demands, including a 5-year sunset clause and a U.S.-specific content rule, will sink the talks and lead to the collapse of NAFTA. Business groups have warned of dire economic consequences, including millions of jobs lost as Mexico and Canadian tariffs snap back to their early levels in the 1990s when NAFTA was put together. I think the administration is playing a pretty dangerous game with this sunset provision. That, according to Representative Charlie Dent, a moderate Republican from eastern Pennsylvania. He said that putting NAFTA under the threat of extinction every 5 years would make it difficult for companies in his district, ranging from chocolate giant Hershey to small family-owned manufacturing firms, to invest in supply chains and manage globe operations. Hershey operates candy plants in Monterey, California, and Guadalajara, Mexico. Some 74 House of Representatives members have signed a letter this week opposing U.S. proposals on automotive rules of origin, which would require 50% U.S. content in NAFTA-built vehicles and 85% in regional content. And Representative Pete Sessions, a Texas Republican who has long been a supporter of free trade deals, said the disagreement with the Trump approach of trying to beat someone in the NAFTA talks. Texas is the largest U.S. exporting state with nearly half of its $231 billion in exports last year alone, headed to Mexico and Canada. And Republican Steve Sessions said, "We need to offer Mexico a fair deal. If we want them to take our cattle, we need to take their avocado." Some pro-labor Democrats have actually expressed support for Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer's tough approach. Some of the demands are in tune, according to Congressman Bill Pascrell of New Jersey, the top Democrat on the House Ways and Means Trade Subcommittee. "We don't want to blow it up. Republicans don't want to blow it up, but we want it substantially changed in the labor area, the environment, the currency, on how you come to an agreement when there's a dispute, and on problems of origin." And of course, farm state Republicans are especially concerned that a collapse of NAFTA would lead to the loss of crucial export markets in Mexico and Canada for corn, beef, and other products. I certainly hear that here in Arizona, on the border with Mexico, with the movement of cattle going both ways across the border, finished cattle from the United States going to Mexico for processing and retailing, and then on the other hand, feeder cattle coming in from Mexico for feeding out here in Arizona. And so anyway, they have to take a wait-and-see attitude as these talks very slowly move along. Now, the session that's underway in Mexico now, the fifth pre-negotiating session, underway, but there's a growing contention between the three participants, despite the fact, really, that since Bill Clinton signed the North American Free Trade Agreement back in the 90s, the three countries have all benefited in one way or another. And as one trade negotiator told me, if one country is really happy with the outcome of the talks, then it probably isn't the fairest trade agreement to continue to build. But we have certainly seen an increase in the agricultural trade back and forth between Canada and Mexico and the United States. And the farmers in all three countries really would have a challenge if indeed the NAFTA agreement was blown up. Probably not a bad idea to renegotiate the trade agreement every 5 years, because the world changes rapidly. And so something that's put in place today may not work 5 years from now. But to blow it up completely and leave the three countries without trade agreements, I think would be a costly situation. So that's where we stand as we go into this weekend and the round of talks in Mexico City. Well, we're going to be talking markets. I think combines are pretty well parked by Thanksgiving. That, for a long time, has been the goal of most grain producers, to have the combine parked in the shed, cleaned, and ready to go next year. So we're going to be talking, Max will sit down and talk with Dale Dirkholz of AgriVisor in Bloomington, Illinois, about the grain market. Well, thank you very much, Roger, for that check on the news. And we're going to be checking on markets shortly on the second half of the Saturday morning show. But right now, we say welcome to Samuelson Says. And I'm Orion Samuelson, this week talking about giving thanks at Thanksgiving time. If you're looking for an easy way to keep your toilet bowls rust-free, I have the answer. RustGuard is the in-tank toilet bowl cleaner that protects against rust and hard water stains with every flush. And RustGuard is safe to use on plumbing and septic systems, and it will not harm pets. That's RustGuard. Check us out at wink.com. That's WHINK.com. Living in this great country should be reason enough to say thank you every day and to give thanks for the opportunity that we have as citizens in this country. But at Thanksgiving week time, we tend to maybe count up the many blessings that we have. I know I certainly do. And so let me compare my list with yours of things for which to be thankful during this Thanksgiving season. First of all, of course, family. To be blessed with a family of children and grandchildren that behave themselves very well and are working hard to make their own careers a reality, I am indeed blessed. And I'm especially blessed with my wife, Gloria, who I have retitled my health warden because of everything she has done during a challenging year for yours truly. And so next on my list would be good health. May you all enjoy good health and remember to say thanks for that. And I also say thank you for the opportunity to live in the age of technology in so many different areas, in agriculture, that enables us to produce food for a growing world population using less of our natural resources. But I'm also grateful for technology in medicine, as I've experienced it during a challenging year in the health category. And then back to living in a country that gives us freedom, not without sacrifice. And I have to toss this in as an aside. It gives the wealthy NFL players the right to protest the wrong way against our flag and national anthem. But it also gives me the opportunity to protest by stopping my support and not making the NFL part of our Thanksgiving get-together this coming week. So all in all, we are blessed, and I hope you share my feelings on my blessings and add some of your own to it. The other thing I'm blessed with is you, my audience, who joins me every week on television and radio to let me share my thoughts with you on Samuelson Says. Samuelson Says, a presentation of the Tribune Radio Networks. And we're at 20 minutes before 6 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show. Coming up, a look at that cattle on feed report that was issued yesterday by the Department of Agriculture. We're going to have ample supplies of beef at mealtime in this country, indeed, because we're adding numbers of cattle to the numbers that will be coming to market between now and the middle of 2018. But the grain market, well, that'll be talked about when we continue here on the Saturday morning show.
Dale Durkos, AgriVisor, sitting in the studio with us this weekend. It's good to see you again,
hey, it's
sir.
Always good to come up and see you.
We saw something the other day from USDA, of course, in terms of a larger, ever larger corn crop. The biggest corn yield ever, much to the surprise of many of the folks in the cab.
Yeah, nobody was really looking for a number that big out of the USDA. But when you go in and you look at it, and I did the other day, all the increase from October to November came in Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, and the two Dakotas. You know, so it was the heart of the Corn Belt that really had big increases in yield and production over the last month.
Well, now, generally we don't worry about this time of year as we're approaching Thanksgiving. There are still a few acres of corn out there. In Wisconsin, I ran the numbers on that. They still have something like 1.2 million acres of standing corn out there where Bambi can hide as the deer hunting season is underway.
You know, and not only that, we have a fair amount of bean acres that are still out in the field up in here. I was surprised on the way up into northern Illinois this morning. The number of bean fields that I saw in northern Illinois, actually, I think saw more bean fields than corn fields. But, you know, as you do get into on up into Wisconsin and parts of Minnesota, and then you start going northwestern corn belt, yeah, there's still a fair amount of corn still waiting to come into the harvest.
We generally get it most all in the bin without any difficulty.
Yeah, and I don't think that's going to be an issue this year because corn, you know, at this point, yeah, maybe you get a little snow, but you can still go out and harvest. It's not really a big issue. The one thing that really is kind of interesting, even some of the later corn harvest, later fields that have been harvested here of recent, you know, we're really not seeing much yield drop off. So the stock standability is holding up real well, and so are the ear shanks.
That's an interesting point. Of course, these stocks are tougher. We've really changed that landscape dramatically over the past decade, haven't we?
Oh, there's no doubt about it, you know, and it really kind of is shocking, you know, in one sense, because you walk out in a cornfield today and a big stock's about the size of a big thumb. And, you know, when I think back to the days of being a kid, you know, a big stock would be about the size of three thumbs, you know, sandwiched around each other. But the stock quality today is a lot better than what it used to be, no doubt about it.
Did this prolonged harvest help us avoid logistics problems that could have developed? I know we're putting a lot outside on the ground, but that was anticipated.
Yeah, you know, we have so many what I call permanent temporary storage facilities anymore. You know, I don't worry too much about corn piles because that's become the norm today in the heart of the Corn Belt for people to put corn out on the ground, you know, and move it somewhere later on into the winter months themselves. Logistics problems haven't been a big issue because the harvest was stretched a little bit. The other thing that I think really probably helped out the logistics issue on the Mississippi River, actually we're right at the end of summer and beginning to harvest, and so, you know, we got over what could have been a huge problem early on, and then the market was able to absorb supplies as they came in.
Have we seen the lows for this season?
Good question. I think probably we have, or if not, you know, we're getting back down close to them again. You know, we really don't have any downside risk in the corn market at this point in time. The big issue is it's going to be a long, dull winter right now. And, you know, farmers are going to have to learn to go back to old days of how do you market corn and doing things like using storage hedges, et cetera, to try to add a little bit to the dollars that they get out of that bushel.
There won't be any big home runs, I suppose, but little by little, producers can improve their situation a bit.
Yeah, they really can. You know, I mean, when you look at the corn market and the huge carry that we have in futures, you know, you got something like Dece to March, 13 cents, and you're another 9 or so going on out to May. You know, you look at those far-distant futures or you look at some of those far-distant cash bids, especially for people that have grain stored at home on the farm. You know, you're going to have to look constantly at those forward bids when you market some corn, and actually I think hedge-to-arrive contracts for them will be the best tool to use.
The other day we saw oil leading the market a little bit, soybean oil helping provide a bit of a lift. What's going on there?
You know, what happened in the bean oil, the NOPA crush that we had this last week, oil yield out of a bushel of beans came in underneath what people were expecting it to be. And along with that, then, we saw that those oil stocks were tighter than expected. And so when you look forward, especially in a realm where we have crude oil and heating oil, diesel fuel that is somewhat higher here, and it looks like we're going to maintain at least a higher price profile, demand for biodiesel ought to be good, but we're still waiting on an EPA announcement or the final EPA announcement there yet.
South America has to remain in our focus, but there don't seem to be major problems there at the moment.
Right now, they're not in South America. You know, we'd been dry in northern Brazil early on, and it looks like, you know, finally the moisture pattern down there has shifted to where we're seeing more moisture up in the center and the northern areas of Brazil. Meanwhile, southern Brazil and down into Argentina have dried out, and they really needed to. They were a little on the wet side. So planting, even though it got off the mark a little bit slow, is getting caught up, and I think, you know, the condition of the crop right now in both places probably going to be seen as pretty good, but the real key becomes, you know, how does the weather unfold going forward, corn in particular.
Mid-December, we'll get a little more interested, I suppose, in soybeans, and then you've got to push the calendar back a bit before you get too excited about corn, right? That's a safrina crop?
Yeah, we shouldn't really call it a safrina crop anymore because that's a little boy or something like that, and the safrina crop is the huge crop now. But yeah, you know, that'll get put in the ground starting somewhere about February. And the issue you worry about with that second crop, how timely does it get planted? And then how quickly do they turn from a rainy season into their dry season? Because they go from a rainy pattern to a dry pattern as you move into March and on into April. So that changeover will have a lot to do with the yield on that second crop corn.
Dale, as unexciting as the picture is at this moment, isn't there almost always, during that South American growing season, something that brings at least a temporary bump up of the market?
No doubt about it. You know, you always see something that comes along down there. People get a little bit anxious about weather, whether it's in Brazil or Argentina. People get anxious about, you know, products not moving so fast. Beans in particular, because with beans, we have such a strong demand base right now. And COFCO out of China the other day said, you know, we could import 100 million ton of beans. And that's higher than the USDA and any of the privates are, you know. And when you look at that, we don't have any room for margin of error with the bean crop down there. And certainly with the corn crop, we know the same thing.
I had to laugh the other day when I saw some of the traders were expressing angst at the fact the Chinese economy maybe wasn't growing as fast as some people had thought it should. I mean, it was only 7+% growth, which is pretty rampant by most standards around the world.
Yeah, you know, people get too anxious, you know. I mean, we go back 10 years ago, China's economy was growing 8, 9, 10, 11%, you know. And, you know, then, you know, when things started to get rather robust over there, all of a sudden their growth rate slowed down and people would get a little bit nervous if they only grew at 7%, you know. And it's called, you know, we started out with a little tennis ball, you know, and now we're working with a huge beach ball. You can't expect it to keep expanding that fast, you know, simply because of the massive size. You know, when you look at the actual size, total aggregate economy, they're a little bit larger than the U.S., although simply because when you look at the population differential on a per capita basis, it's still a lot smaller than ours. But, you know, we can't sustain those 9, 10, 11% growth rates. It's just impossible because of the size of activity they've come into.
The guy in North Korea gets shoved off the front page by all this other ancillary stuff going on. But how concerned are you folks in the commodity industry about watching him and what he may or may not do?
I really don't know how to answer that because that's really a huge geopolitical question. I don't know what it means to commodities. I don't think anybody really knows. The only thing you can really say when you get into something like that, generally, war is bullish commodities. So the longer he doesn't do something means that it becomes a neutral to a negative. But if he ever starts flexing his muscle, then people start to get worried. But because there's such a close alliance between North Korea and China, you worry about the flip side. Will it force China to start to pull back from the world a little bit if tensions with North Korea really rise? And that would be a negative in the commodity environment out in the world if China starts to pull back. So it's not an easy question to answer.
Conversely, if they were to side with the United States and rein this guy in a bit, that wouldn't be bad at all, would it?
Actually, that would be a net overall plus because it would, number one, ratchet tensions down. That would have a positive ramification as far as economic activity, especially in the Asian realm. And as long as we keep their economies growing at a robust pace, you know, I think that's really good for commodities and commodity demand in general.
We have an ambassador there now who was the governor of Iowa a couple of times for many years. We thought he'd be the governor for life. Terry Branstad sitting over there with a very close connection with the grain industry of the United States cannot hurt, can it, Dale?
No, and the other thing is he also knows Prime Minister Xi really well, too. And I think that's probably the real big beneficiary in that environment is that he is already familiar with the political power structure in China and will be able to move and see things going on and probably get a bit better communication than if we had some East Coast politician sitting over there in Beijing. And yes, his connection into agriculture, that's only a plus for us in agriculture. And not just in the grain market. Let's talk about meat. You know, and I'm getting ready to do a presentation this winter for the Illinois Soybean Association. And I'm going to really start off the presentation talking about where everybody's at around the world on relative meat consumption. And when you start looking at that, especially in realm of the article we just came out with, meat is a definite required source for human protein needs as well as other benefits that we get from consuming meat in this country.
It's great to talk to you as always, and we appreciate you coming in to join us this weekend, Dale. Happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, and good being here.
Dale Durkholz from AgriVisor.
We are 4 minutes away from news time here on WGN Radio Chicago. Yesterday,
afternoon, the Department of Agriculture issued the November Cattle on Feed report. And yes, I think we'll have ample supplies of beef going into the winter season. Here are the numbers of cattle on feed November 1st, up 6% from a year ago. And placements in feedlots during October totaled 2,390,000 head, 10% above a year ago. And the number of fed cattle marketed during October, 1,800,000. That's 6% above a year ago. As we watched the cattle market trade yesterday ahead of that report, we did see the market again showing, well, mostly a lower trend. December live cattle futures down 77 cents a hundredweight yesterday, putting it at $118.85. January feeder cattle down $2.50 a hundredweight, and trade will start Monday at $151.72. December live hogs, on the other hand, gained 42 cents yesterday to end the week at $60.65 a hundredweight. So the cattle market continues to do its ups and downs that it's been doing for the last year or so. Meanwhile, hog numbers and the hog market there yesterday, we saw the grain market. We saw the grain market move with great gains in soybeans, particularly January soybeans up 20 cents a bushel. And that's our time here on the Saturday Morning Show. As always, we appreciate your company. Keep in mind, it's a holiday shortened trading week. Markets will be closed on Thursday in observance of Thanksgiving Day. And they'll be open just half a day on Friday. So keep that in mind as you make your trading plans. And in Minneapolis today, the final session of the annual gathering of American women in agriculture. And one of the surprising things to me, at least, the fact that in this country, 30% of farmers are now women. 30%. And I'm speaking to you from Arizona this morning, and in Arizona, the percentage of ladies in farming, 45% of the ladies in Arizona are involved in the Arizona agriculture. So anyway, have a blessed and safe Thanksgiving week, and we'll be back with you next Saturday on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Radio and WGNRadio.com. And if you're an Amazon Echo user, simply say, play WGN Radio on TuneIn.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.